Greetings, listeners. We're back once again to talk to you about the Cthulhu mythos, its books, its monsters, its unfortunate human casualties, its timeline in general, and even its tangential bits like the dreamlands, or things of a weird nature, or things that are Lovecraftian leaning. Weird fiction, science fiction, horror, learn of terrible meetings in lonely places, of cyclopean ruins and vast staircases that lead down to abysses of nighted secrets, of complex angles that lead through invisible walls to other regions of space and time, and of hideous explorations in remote and forbidden places, on other worlds, and in different time-space continua. From the creation of our galaxy to the death of the sun, this is an exploration of the Cthulhu mythos from the perspective of humans' concept of history. We are the people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos. You can find us at pgttcm.com, pgttcm.podbean.com, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. The people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos starts now.
The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Season 8.
This episode is brought to you by FoundAdamClothing.com and BunnySlippers.com. Subscribe to PGTTCM with DB Spitzer and Seraphie wherever you subscribe to podcasts. We use Podbean and Apple Podcasts personally. Check out our new website over at www.pgttcm.com. Check out the new PGTTCM merch over at pgttcm.threadless.com. Follow on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as PGTTCM and YouTube as People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Edited by Daniel Spitzer. Music by Kevin MacLeod. Help the show out by sharing, rating, and five-star giving wherever you listen and rate podcasts. Support the show by hitting the patron button at pgttcm.com or pgttcm.podbean.com or by going to paypal.me/pgttcm. Again, cool shirts at pgttcm.threadless.com. PGTTCM is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Check them out at darkmyths.org. The Sword of Welleran and Other Stories is the third book by Irish fantasy writer Lord Dunsany. Considered a major influence on the work of Tolkien, Lovecraft, Le Guin, and others, it was first published in hardcover by George Allen and Sons in October 1908. So, about 100 years ago, for anyone who's keeping track, about 110 years ago, for anyone who's keeping track with math skills. And this is read by Ed Humpall, Alex Clark, Lean Tipping, Alex D, and Kevin D, Jaris Amar, Steve Vito, Asef Koss, Rosalind Carlisle, and Sandra. All right, let's get going. Enjoy this Lord Dunsany for this second or third week of October as we are part of Lord Dunsany's untitled October extravaganza for the month of October, because Daniel didn't come up with a catchy title. Month of October. All right, on with the show.
The Sword of Welleran and Other Stories by Lord Dunsany. Section 11. The Lord of Cities. I came one day upon a road that wandered so aimlessly that it was suited to my mood, so I followed it, and it led me presently among deep woods. Somewhere in the midst of them, autumn held his court, sitting wreathed with gorgeous garlands, and it was the day before his annual festival of the Dance of Leaves, the courtly festival upon which hungry winter rushes mob-like, and there arise the furious cries of the north wind triumphing, and the splendor and grace of the woods is gone, and autumn flees away, discrowned, and forgotten and never again returns. Other autumns arise, other autumns, and fall before other winters. A road led away to the left, but my road went straight on. The road to the left had a trodden appearance. There were wheel tracks on it, and it seemed the correct way to take. It looked as if no one could have any business with the road that led straight on and up the hill. Therefore, I went straight on and up the hill. And here and there on the road grew blades of grass undisturbed in the repose and hush that the road had earned from going up and down the world. For you can go by this road, as you can go by all roads, to London, to Lincoln, to the north of Scotland, to the west of Wales, and to Wrellisford, where roads end. Presently the woods ended, and I came to the open fields, and at the same moment to the top of the hill, and saw the high places of Somerset and the downs of Wilts spread out along the horizon. Suddenly I saw underneath me the village of Wrellisford, with no sound in its street but the voice of the Wrellis roaring as he tumbled over a weir above the village. So I followed my road down over the crest of the hill, and the road became more languid as I descended, and less concerned with the cares of a highway. Here a spring broke out in the middle of it, and here another. The road never heeded. A stream ran right across it, still it straggled on. Suddenly it gave up the minimum property that a road should possess, and, renouncing its connection with high streets, its lineage of Piccadilly, shrank to one side and became an unpretentious footpath. Then it led me to the old bridge over the stream, and thus I came to Wrellisford, and found, after traveling in many lands, a village with no wheel tracks in its street. On the other side of the bridge, my friend the road struggled a few yards up the grassy slope, and there ceased. Over all the village hung a great stillness, with the roar of the Wrellis cutting right across it, and there came occasionally the bark of a dog that kept watch over the broken stillness and over the sanctity of that untraveled road. That terrible and wasting fever that, unlike so many plagues, comes not from the east but from the west, the fever of hurry, had not come here. Only the Wrellis hurried on his eternal quest, but it was a calm and placid hurry that gave one time for song. It was in the early afternoon, and nobody was about. Either they worked beyond the mysterious valley that nursed Wrellisford and hid it from the world, or else they secluded themselves within their old-time houses that were roofed with tiles of stone. I sat down upon the old stone bridge and watched the Wrellis, who seemed to me to be the only traveler that came from far away into this village where roads end, and passed on beyond it. And yet the Wrellis comes singing out of eternity, and tarries for very little while in the village where roads end, and passes on into eternity again, and so surely do all that dwell in Wrellisford. I wondered, as I leaned upon the bridge, in what place the Wrellis would first find the sea, whether as he wound idly through meadows on his long quest he would suddenly behold him, and, leaping down over some rocky cliff, take to him at once the message of the hills, or whether, widening slowly into some grand and tidal estuary, he would take his waste of waters to the sea, and the might of the river should meet with the might of the waves, like two emperors clad in gleaming mail meeting midway between two hosts of war, and the little Wrellis would become a haven for returning ships, and a setting out place for adventurous men. A little beyond the bridge there stood an old mill with a ruined roof, and a small branch of the Wrellis rushed through its emptiness shouting, like a boy playing alone in a corridor of some desolate house. The mill wheel was gone, but there lay there still great bars and wheels and cogs, the bones of some dead industry. I know not what industry was once lord in that house. I know not what retinue of workers mourns him now.
We'd like to thank you for listening to People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Our sponsor is BunnySlippers.com, your finest source of wonderful Cthulhu slippers, and cool, cool shirts from FoundItemClothing.com, your favorite shirts from your favorite cult films, and also these fine folks.
Now, I only know who is Lord there today in all those empty chambers. For as soon as I entered, I saw a whole wall draped with his marvelous black tapestry, without price, because inimitable and too delicate to pass from hand to hand among merchants. I looked at the wonderful complexity of its infinite threads. My finger sank into it for more than an inch without feeling the touch. So black it was, and so carefully wrought, somberly covering the whole of the wall, that it might have been worked to commemorate the deaths of all that ever lived there, as indeed it was. I looked through a hole in the wall into the inner chamber where a worn-out driving band went among many wheels, and there this priceless, inimitable stuff not merely clothed the walls, but hung from bars and ceilings in beautiful draperies, in marvelous festoons. Nothing was ugly in this desolate house, for the busy artist's soul of its present lord had beautified everything in its desolation. It was the unmistakable work of the spider, in whose house I was, and the house was utterly desolate but for him, and silent but for the roar of the relish and the shout of the little stream. Then I turned homewards, and as I went up and over the hill and lost sight of the village, I saw the road whiten and harden, and gradually broaden out till the tracks of wheels appeared, and it went afar to take the young man of Relisford into the wide ways of the earth, to the new west and the mysterious east, and into the troubled south. And that night, when the house was still and sleep was far off, hushing hamlets and giving ease to cities, my fancies wandered up that aimless road and came suddenly to Relisford. And it seemed to me that the traveling of so many people for so many years between Relisford and John O'Groats, talking to one another as they went or muttering alone, had given the road a voice. And it seemed to me that night that the road spoke to the river by Relisford Bridge, speaking with the voice of many pilgrims. And the road said to the river, "I rest here. How is it with you?" And the river, who is always speaking, said, "I rest nowhere from doing the work of the world. I carry the murmur of inner lands to the sea, and to the abysses, voices of the hills." "It is I," said the road, "that do the work of the world, and take from city to city the rumor of each. There is nothing higher than man in the making of cities. What do you do for man?" And the river said, "Beauty and song are higher than man. I carry the news seaward of the first song of the thrush after the furious retreat of winter northward, and the first timid anemone learns from me that she is safe and that spring has truly come. Oh, but the song of all the birds in spring is more beautiful than man, and the first coming of the hyacinth more delectable than his face. When spring is fallen upon the days of summer, I carry away with mournful joy at night, petal by petal, the rhododendron's bloom. No lit procession of purple kings is nigh so fair as that. No beautiful death of well-beloved men hath such a glory of forlornness. And I bear away the pink and white petals of the apple blossom's youth, when the laborious time comes for his work in the world and for the bearing of apples. And I am robed each day and every night anew with the beauty of heaven, and I make lovely visions of the trees. But man, what is man? In the ancient parliament of the elder hills, when the gray ones speak together, they say naught of man, but concern themselves only with their brethren the stars. Or when they wrap themselves in purple cloaks at evening, they lament some old irreparable wrong, or, uttering some mountain hymn, all mourn the set of sun." "Your beauty," said the road, "and the beauty of the sky, and of the rhododendron blossoms, and of spring, live only in the mind of man, and except in the mind of man the mountains have no voices. Nothing is beautiful that has not been seen by man's eye, and if your rhododendron blossom was beautiful for a moment, It soon withered and was drowned, and spring soon passes away. Beauty can only live on in the mind of man. I bring thought into the mind of man swiftly from distant places every day. I know the telegraph. I know him well. He and I have walked for hundreds of miles together. There is no work in the world except for man and the making of his cities. I take wares to and fro from city to city. My little stream in the field there, said the river, used to make wares in that house for a while, once. Ah, said the road, I remember. But I brought cheaper ones from distant cities. Nothing is of any importance but making cities for man. I know so little about him, said the river, but I have a great deal of work to do. I have all this water to send down to the sea, and then tomorrow or next day all the leaves of autumn will be coming this way. It will be very beautiful. The sea is a very, very wonderful place. I know all about it. I have heard shepherd boys singing of it, and sometimes before a storm the gulls come up. It is a place all blue and shining and full of pearls, and has in it coral islands and isles of spice, and storms and galleons and the bones of Drake. The sea is much greater than man. When I come to the sea, he will know that I have worked well for him. But I must hurry, for I have much to do. This bridge delays me a little. Some day I will carry it away. Oh, you must not do that, said the road. Oh, not for a long time, said the river. Some centuries, perhaps. And I have much to do besides. There is my song to sing, for instance, and that alone is more beautiful than any noise that man makes. All work is for man, said the road, and for the building of cities. There is no beauty or romance or mystery in the sea, except for the men that sail abroad upon it, and for those that stay at home and dream of them. As for your song, it rings night and morning, year in, year out, in the ears of men that are born in Rellisford. At night it is part of their dreams. At morning it is the voice of day, and so it becomes part of their souls. But the song is not beautiful in itself. I take these men, with your song in their souls, up over the edge of the valley and a long way off beyond, and I am a strong and dusty road up there, and they go with your song in their souls and turn it into music and gladden cities. But nothing is the work of the world except work for man. I wish I was quite sure about the work of the world, said the stream. I wish I knew for certain for whom we work. I feel almost sure that it is for the sea. He is very great and beautiful. I think that there can be no greater master than the sea. I think that some day he may be so full of romance and mystery and sound of sheep bells and murmur of mist-hidden hills which we streams have brought him that there will be no more music or beauty left in the world, and all the world will end. And perhaps the streams shall gather at the last, we all together, to the sea. Or perhaps the sea will give us at the last each one his own again, giving back all that he has garnered in the years, the little petals of the apple blossom, and the mourned ones of the rhododendron, and our old visions of the trees and sky. So many memories have left the hills. But who may say? For who knows the tides of the sea? Be sure that it is all for man, said the road, for man and the making of cities. Something had come near, on utterly silent feet. Peace, peace, it said, you disturb the queenly night, who, having come into this valley, is a guest in my dark halls. Let us have an end to this discussion. It was the spider who spoke. The work of the world is the making of cities and palaces, but it is not for man. What is man? He only prepares my cities for me and mellows them. All his works are ugly, his richest tapestries are coarse and clumsy. He is a noisy idler. He only protects me from mine enemy the wind, and the beautiful work in my cities, the curving outlines and the delicate weavings, is all mine. 10 years to 100 it takes to build a city. For 500 or 600 more, it mellows and is prepared for me. Then I inhabit it, and hide away all that is ugly, and draw beautiful lines about it to and fro. There is nothing so beautiful as cities and palaces. They are the loveliest places in the world, because they are the stillest, and so most like the stars. They are noisy at first, for a little, before I come to them. They have ugly corners not yet rounded off, and coarse tapestries, and when they become ready for me and my exquisite work, they are quite silent and beautiful. And there I entertain the regal knights, when they come there jeweled with stars, and all their train of silence, and regale them with costly dust. Already nods, in a city that I wot of, a lonely sentinel whose lords are dead, who grows too old and sleepy to drive away the gathering silence that infests the streets. Tomorrow I go to see if he be still at his post. For me Babylon was built, and rocky Tyre, and still men build my cities. All the work of the world is the making of cities, and all of them I inherit.
The Doom of La Traviata. Evening stole up out of mysterious lands and came down on the streets of Paris, and the things of the day withdrew themselves and hid away, and the beautiful city was strangely altered, and with it the hearts of men. And with lights and music and in silence and in the dark, the other life arose, the life that knows the night. And dark cats crept from the houses and moved to silent places, and dim streets became haunted with dusk shapes. At this hour, in a mean house, near to the Moulin Rouge, La Traviata died, and her death was brought to her by her own sins and not by the years of God. But the soul of La Traviata drifted blindly about the streets where she had sinned, till it struck against the wall of Notre Dame de Paris. Thence it rushed upwards, as the sea mist when it beats against a cliff, and streamed away to paradise, and was there judged. And it seemed to me, as I watched from my place of dreaming, when La Traviata came and stood before the seat of judgment, that clouds came rushing up from the far paradisal hills, and gathered together over the head of God, and became one black cloud, and the clouds moved swiftly as shadows of the night, when a lantern is swung in the hand, and more clouds rushed up, and ever more and more, and, as they gathered, the cloud a little above the head of God became no larger, but only grew blacker and blacker. And the halos of the saints settled lower upon their heads and narrowed and became pale, and the singing of the choirs of the seraphim faltered and sunk low, and the converse of the blessed suddenly ceased. Then a stern look came into the face of God, so that the seraphim turned away and left him and the saints. Then God commanded, and 7 great angels rose up slowly through the clouds that carpet paradise, and there was pity on their faces, and their eyes were closed. Then God pronounced judgment, and the lights of paradise went out, and the azure crystal windows that looked toward the world, and the windows rouge and vert became dark and colorless, and I saw no more. Presently the 7 great angels came out by one of heaven's gates, and set their faces hellwards. And 4 of them carried the young soul of La Traviata, and 1 of them went on before, and 1 of them followed behind. These 6 trod with mighty strides the long and dusty road that is named the Way of the Damned. But the 7th flew above them all the way, and the lights of the fires of hell that was hidden from the 6 by the dust of that dreadful road flared on the feathers of his breast. Presently the seven angels, as they swept hellwards, uttered speech. "She is very young," they said, "and she is very beautiful," they said. And they looked long at the soul of La Traviata, looking not at the stains of sin, but at that portion of her soul wherewith she had loved her sister a long while dead, who flitted now about an orchard on one of heaven's hills, with a low sunlight ever on her face, who communed daily with the saints when they passed that way, going to bless the dead from heaven's utmost edge. And as they looked long at the beauty of all that remained beautiful in her soul, they said, "It is but a young soul." And they would have taken her to one of heaven's hills, and would there have given her a cymbal and a dulcimer. But they knew that the paradisal gates were clamped and barred against La Traviata. And they would have taken her to a valley in the world where there were a great many flowers and a loud sound of streams, where birds were singing always and church bells rang on Sabbaths. Only this they durst not do. So they swept onwards nearer and nearer hell. But when they were come quite close and the glare was on their faces, and they saw the gates already divide and prepare to open outwards, they said, "Hell is a terrible city, and she is tired of cities." Then suddenly they dropped her by the side of the road and wheeled and flew away. But into a great pink flower that was horrible and lovely grew the soul of La Traviata, and it had in it two eyes but no eyelids, and it stared constantly into the faces of all the passers-by that went along the dusty road to hell. And the flower grew in the glare of the lights of hell, and withered but could not die. Only one petal turned back toward the heavenly hills, as an ivy leaf turns outwards to the day, and in the soft and silvery light of paradise it withered not nor faded, but heard at times the commune of the saints coming murmuring from the distance, and sometimes caught the scent of orchards wafted from the heavenly hills, and felt a faint breeze cool it every evening at the hour when the saints to heaven's edge went forth to bless the dead. But the Lord arose with his sword and scattered his disobedient angels as a thresher scatters chaff.
On the dry land. Over the marshes hung the gorgeous night with all his wandering bands of nomad stars, and his whole host of still ones blinked and watched. Over the safe dry land to the eastward, grey and cold, the first clear pallor of dawn was coming up above the heads of the immortal gods. Then, as they neared at last the safety of the dry land, Love looked at the man whom he had led for so long through the marshes and saw that his hair was white, for it was shining in the pallor of the dawn. Then they stepped together onto the land, and the old man sat down weary on the grass, for they had wandered in the marshes for many years, and the light of the grey dawn widened above the heads of the gods. And Love said to the old man, "I will leave you now." And the old man made no answer, but wept softly. Then Love was grieved in his little careless heart, and he said, "You must not be sorry that I go, nor yet regret me, nor care for me at all. I am a very foolish child, and was never kind to you, nor friendly. I never cared for your great thoughts, or for what was good in you, but perplexed you by leading you up and down the perilous marshes, and I was so heartless that, had you perished where I led you, it would have been naught to me. And I only stayed with you because you were good to play with, and I am cruel and altogether worthless, and not such a one as any should be sorry for when I go, or one to be regretted or even cared for at all. And still the old man spoke not, but wept softly, and love grieved bitterly in his kindly heart. And love said, "Because I am so small, my strength has been concealed from you and the evil that I have done. But my strength is great, and I have used it unjustly. Often I pushed you from the causeway through the marshes, and cared not if you drowned. Often I mocked you and caused others to mock you, and often I led you among those that hated me and laughed when they revenged themselves upon you. So weep not, for there is no kindness in my heart, but only murder and foolishness, and I am no companion for one so wise as you. But I am so frivolous and silly that I laughed at your noble dreams and hindered all of your deeds. See, now you have found me out, and now you will send me away, and here you will live at ease and undisturbed, have noble dreams of the immortal gods. See now, here is dawn and safety, and there is darkness and peril." Still the old man wept softly. Then love said, "Is it thus with you?" And his voice was grave now and quiet. "Are you so troubled, old friend of so many years? There is grief in my heart for you, old friend of perilous ventures. I must leave you now, but I will send my brother soon to you, my little brother Death, and he will come up out of the marshes to you, and will not forsake you, but will be true to you as I have not been true." And dawn grew brighter over the immortal gods, and the old man smiled through his tears, which glistened wondrously in the increasing light. But love went down to the night and to the marshes, looking backward over his shoulder as he went, and smiling beautifully about his eyes. And in the marshes whereunto he went, in the midst of the gorgeous night, and under the wandering bands of nomad stars, rose shouts of laughter and the sounds of the dance. And after a while, with his face towards the morning, Death out of the marshes came up tall and beautiful, and with a faint smile shadowy on his lips, and lifted in his arms the lonely man, being gentle with him, and, murmuring with his low, deep voice an ancient song, carried him to the morning, to the gods.
Thank you again for joining us for The Sword of Welleran and Other Stories by Lord Dunsany. This is October, so expect this for more of October, and hope you really enjoy the stories. And we'll figure out what we're going to do for November, but Lord Dunsany right now. Thanks again to BunnySlippers.com, FoundItemClothing.com, and DarkMyths.org. All right, have a good day. And remember, keep it weird and stay squiggly.